Sorry.
It's okay.
Am I on? Okay, we'll start. Hello, I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, Emeritus Professor of Architecture. We start with the Cornell's land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Call to order. The first order of business is approval of the minutes, which is pro forma. In other words, they are already distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript. So hearing no corrections, they are approved as posted by unanimous consent. Our first real order of business is an address by President Martha Pollack, Computer Science, for 10 minutes, and then there should be 15 minutes or so for Q&A after that.
Thank you, yes, and I'm gonna keep my comments about 10 minutes and then go right to Q&A, including Q&A, that were a couple of questions that were pre-submitted. I do hope everybody's semester is going well. It's really nice to be here. We have with us on campus over the past year added 100 exceptional new faculty, which is really great. We're glad to have them, as well as our newest Cornellians, the class of 2026. They are spectacular. 18.5% of them, by the way, are first generation in college. As I always do, I'd like to start very briefly with some of our academic distinction, because that, of course, is the hallmark of our excellence here. There are enormous number of faculty accolades. I'm going to simply point out a couple of them. First of all, I want to note that John Kleinberg, the Tisch University Professor of Computer Science and Information Science, has been appointed by the United States Department of Commerce to a newly established committee that's going to advise the United States President on issues related to artificial intelligence. This National AI Advisory Committee will provide recommendations on topics including AI competitiveness in the US, the state of science around AI and AI workforce issues. And it's really going to be critical to helping the nation lead in the ethical, and I want to stress that, ethical development and adoption of AI. John is one of only seven academics on this panel. I also want to highlight Mijin Yoon, who of course you know is the Dean, the Ira, Gail and Ira Drucker Dean of our College of Art, Architecture and Planning. She was given the 2002 World Cultural Council's Leonardo da Vinci World Award of Arts, which honors performing, creative, or visionary artists who, quote, lift our existence to a higher level by the beauty or inspiration of their creative thought. And of course, the eight recipients of the 2002 Stephen H. Weiss Award have been announced. You can read about them in the Cornell Chronicle article that ran a few weeks ago. They are a terrific cohort, and as you know, they are recognized for their outstanding contributions to undergraduate teaching and mentoring. Now, there are a number of ways to measure faculty impact. Another of them is the success of our graduates. And here I want to call out just two recent accomplishments. One, and I'm sorry to give another computer science example, but Manish Raghavan, MS 18 and PhD 21, received the 2021 ACM Doctoral Dissertation Award for his dissertation, The Societal Impacts of Algorithmic Decision Making. The reason I call this out is that there are more than 1,800 PhDs in computer science given every year in this country, and he is the single winner of the Doctoral Dissertation Award from the Premier Professional Association. So kudos to Manish and to all the faculty who mentored him. Also among this year's MacArthur Fellows, the Genius Award winners, are two Cornell alumni, Yijin Choi, MS-09, who's a member of the faculty at the University of Washington, working on natural language processing and computer vision, and artist and architect Amanda Williams, class of 97, whose work expresses color, race, and space. Faculty impact can also, I believe, be measured in research activity. And it's important to note that in FY fiscal year 21, the year that just ended last summer, our sponsored research expenditures were $804.6 million, which continues a steady multi-year upward trend. In fact, over the past 5 years, we've seen a 36% increase in federal funding, a 61% increase in NIH funding, that's here on the Ithaca in Cornell Tech, and a 52% increase in corporate funding. We also have a new cross-campus collaboration to announce. Earlier this semester, our Cornell Institute for Engineering and Innovations in Medicine held its research kickoff symposium. This is a really exciting initiative that I'm sure is going to lead to important advances in human health, building on our expertise in medicine and engineering. Now, I'm personally very excited about this for a couple of reasons. One, a few months ago, I had a new knee put in place with a robotic assisted arm. So I understand what engineering could do for medicine. Also, my own research in computer science had to do with the design of intelligent technology for people with cognitive impairment. But more seriously, I just really think that the research opportunities that are going to be pursued in this institute are going to lead to amazing results, both in the engineering fields and in the fields of biomedical science. I know a lot of people are interested in our continuing efforts on operational sustainability. So if you haven't heard, over the summer, we finished drilling our two-mile-deep Cornell University borehole observatory, Kubo. This is where we're exploring earth source heating. So again, the idea is you pump water down 2 miles, you let it heat up in the earth down there, you pump it back up, you put it in a heat exchanger where it heats a separate source of water, and then that separate source of water will go around campus and heat our buildings. If this approach is successful, and we've only taken the first step, but if it's successful, it could not only enable us to achieve our goal of carbon neutrality by 2035 on the Ithaca campus, it really could lead the way for similar renewable energy efforts and elsewhere. And our work in operational sustainability is getting national attention. So we again received a platinum rating from ASHI. For those of you who follow these things, ASHI is the Association for the Advancement of Sustainability in Higher Education. Only a handful of universities have received a platinum rating, and we are the first to receive it 3 times in a row. And of course, our capacity for excellence depends in large measure on the generosity of our alumni and our friends. So I am really just delighted and grateful to report that we had the best fundraising year in Cornell's history. New gifts and commitments last year reached $902 million, so almost $1 billion. And with these gifts, we're doing everything from hiring new faculty to increasing financial aid for us undergraduates so we have more socioeconomic diversity to building new important facilities. On that topic, at least the topic of undergraduate socioeconomic diversity, I do want to return briefly to a topic I talked about with you back in May, and that's student affordability and access. It is one of the key challenges we're focusing on, and it's deeply connected to larger questions of equity and inclusion in our core ethos. Now, cost is always a key issue. To some extent, tuition increases are inevitable because of a complex set of factors that affect all institutions of higher education. The most significant factor is that we're very labor intensive. The biggest proportion of our expenses by far come from salaries and benefits. And many of our employees, including all of our faculty, are very highly educated, and that impacts salaries as well. And of course, currently compounding those factors is the inflation we've seen last year, which increases costs across the board. We are working very hard to be responsible in controlling costs while still always maintaining our academic excellence. So for example, our university-wide functional review continues. That's the goal of ensuring that we continue to provide high quality support to faculty and students while keeping our staff members from growing too quickly. As I mentioned in May, and I'll mention again, and I mention again and again, we have very ambitious goals in the current philanthropic campaign to improve student affordability. Specifically, we're looking to raise $500 million, $500 million, to increase the number of students who receive aid by 1,000 at the same time as we're growing the student body by 800. 2,000 was the baseline year. We want to reduce average student debt by 25%. And we want to waive the summer savings expectation for our lowest income students so that every undergraduate has the opportunity to spend at least one summer doing an unpaid internship or some other kind of educational activity. We have so far raised $300 million towards that goal. There's just been a really strong positive response from our alumni who strongly identify with wanting to be a university for any person. We do also have ambitious goals to increase graduate and professional student aid, but as is true with all things at the graduate and professional level, it's very different unit from unit because the needs and the way of funding students are very different. We also introduced a number of recent changes to make the Cornell experience more equitable to students of all backgrounds. All of you know about CAMP, the Cornell Academic Materials Program. It was launched this semester, and it allows students a digital-first course material program for a flat fee of $225 a semester. For students on financial aid, that camp fee is covered, and in fact, students are fully funded on financial aid. We didn't reduce the amount that they got for books and awards, so they're still getting $970, even though a full year of camp only costs $450. We also implemented a new universal dining meal plan. All first-year students are required to take it, and it's open to all upperclassmen, too, sophomores, juniors, and seniors. It gives them unlimited access to our dining halls at the same cost of what used to be the 14-meal plan. And we're doing that even though our cost of food has gone way up. It's covered by financial aid. And again, the goal is to reduce food insecurity and also, frankly, socially, to increase students' opportunity for in-person interactions. I do also want to mention our Office of First Generation and Low-Income Student Support. This is within the Office of Dean of Students, and we actually have its own associate dean who is endowed. We are the only university in the Ivies, and I think even the Ivy Plus, who have endowed this position, and I think that really is a sign of our commitment to these students. And finally, before I turn to questions, I do want to acknowledge that equity of access doesn't only involve finances. Very importantly, it involves our admissions policies. We are all paying very, very close attention to the cases that were just heard at the Supreme Court, the Harvard and the UNC cases. The decision could have profound implications for admissions at universities like ours. So we are already engaging in discussions and plans about how we will respond, whatever the outcome. I think I stayed within my 10 minutes. And I would like to do the two questions that were submitted in advance and then open it for other questions.
Sure.
So one question I got was, how can we make sure that Cornell remains one of the best places to do research in the world? And frankly, the shorter answer is by getting the very best faculty and ensuring that they have the environment and the resources they need to do their work. Let me give you a few specific examples. In the last 4 years, from the core, we've invested $22 million from central funds in the Radical Collaborations Initiative, and the colleges and schools have added another 25% to that. We've also put from the core another $50 million towards faculty hiring and retention, and about another $10 million a year towards other things like classroom renovations, teaching innovation grants, academic technology, and so on. We're investing in key facilities, CHESS. All of you know CHESS. We've put more than $10 million into CHESS. Atkinson Hall, which is now under construction up on Tower Road and is going to be the home for the Atkinson Center for Sustainability, the Department of Computational Biology, and the Center for Cancer Biology, and also the Center for Immunology. We've added, we've raised money for it, and we've put in $40 million from the center. Construction for the new CIS building, desperately needed, students were sitting on the floor. That's begun. Thanks to generous donations from alumni, we haven't had to financially support that, but we have had to put in for some related costs like relocating the baseball field. And very good news for those of you who don't know, we're kicking off a multifaceted plan for McGraw Hall. To finally renovate McGraw Hall, we've secured a solid $100 million plus funding plan, a combination of donors, approved debt, and university resources. I'll be really brief, but also mention that the library gets significant funding, $52 million in central allocation, $6 million from other revenue sources, overall then a $60 million budget. The Johnson Museum gets about $2.5 million in central allocated support and another $3 million in support from the endowment. And the botanical gardens, which are primarily supported by investment income. So we really are trying to provide resources for faculty to do their work. And then real quickly, the other question I got was, what are we doing about graduate student productivity? And this is an issue. The pandemic has been it's been hard on everybody. I think in many ways, it's been particularly hard on our graduate students, especially our new graduate students. And really all I can say here is we all have to work closely with our graduate students, monitor their progress, communicate expectations clearly, and ensure that they are making timely progress towards their degrees. I know there are a number of faculty who are collaborating with Dean Bohr on these issues, on mentorship. I think our return to being fully everybody in person is helping, but it's certainly something we all have to watch.
Great.
Those were the pre-questions.
And if anyone in the in-person audience has a question, please step up to the microphone here. We usually start with Zoom questions because it's a little quicker. If I see any hands here. Sometimes I have difficulty, but we'll wait just a minute while people figure out. You can raise your hand in Zoom or come to the front if you're in person. I see S.C. Pryor on Zoom. Why don't you identify yourself and your department and try to make it brief?
Hello, my name is Sarah Pryor. I'm from Earth and Atmospheric Sciences. Thank you for joining us. Clearly, inflationary pressures and remuneration is an issue for all faculty members. Do you yet have a sense of actions you might implement to ensure that we are not continuing to lose in the salary stakes?
Yes, we are just now, this is the time of year when we put together the budget for next year, and we are just now doing that. And of course, one of the important parameters in the budget is the SIP pool, the Salary Improvement Program pool. We are very aware of the inflationary factors. I'm not sure that, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know that we're going to be able to get an increase that is as much as inflation, but we are working towards a pool that is significantly higher than it's been in the past. And we, to be honest, we are paying particular attention to programs for our lowest paid staff, who are the ones who I think are most seriously impacted by the inflationary pressures. So thank you for that question.
In person, identify yourself.
Buzz Barstow, Biological and Environmental Engineering. I want to thank you for, I think I asked those pre-questions.
Oh, okay. Well, then you don't get to ask another one. No,
I wanted to follow up on them. In terms of faculty productivity, mm-hmm. and sort of research output, my question was really geared at sort of how do we reduce the sort of administrative burden on the faculty? How do we increase the amount of time that they get to spend on research? Likewise, how do we increase the amount of time they get to spend mentoring their grad students as well?
Yeah, well, look, anytime people have a suggestion of how we can reduce administrative burden, let us know. It is true, and you know, I suffer from this, Mike suffers from this, all of us suffer from this, that there are increasing compliance requirements that are put onto us from the outside, and we have no option. I mean, we have to do them or we're not in compliance with federal law. Beyond that, we're always open to suggestions about ways in which we can reduce burden.
I'll follow up just briefly. You know, I would love to thank the administration for their work on things like the 2030 project for doing fast grants and the Sprout program as well, that's being launched by the College of Engineering. I just urge you guys to sort of double down on those initiatives as well.
And so one thing I want to encourage you to do also is also go at the dean level, because a lot of those programs come out at the school and college level. So also bring those ideas to your deans.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, not seeing a Zoom hand. We'll have the next in-person speaker. Please identify yourself.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm Tara Holm. I'm from the math department.
Hi.
Thank you for being here and for your vision and leadership. One addition to the last comment. I agree absolutely on supporting staff on SIP. That's so important. And to reduce burden on faculty, we need more staff. We're drowning, and we just got back to full staff in the math department, but that's not enough.
Okay.
Another question that I had, and Mike is going to roll his eyes because I say this to him every time I see him.
I'll let him answer.
I appreciate the fundraising and so forth. I appreciate the support of student financial aid, increasing the student body, increasing the faculty to accommodate the increased student body. We need classrooms. We just looked at pre-enrollment. We're still in pre-enrollment, and there are, as of 3:15 this afternoon, 55 students on the wait list for linear algebra for engineers, and they need that for their degree. The problem, we don't have a classroom that will accommodate.
I am going to have to let Mike answer that, because I don't have a good answer.
Yeah, thanks, Tara.
Yeah. But I will say, as a computer scientist, I'm thrilled that there's a lot of people taking math. That's good.
Thanks, Tara. This is a complicated question, as you know. Talked about the fact that we have an issue around spreading our courses around so that we effectively use the classrooms that we have. That's issue one. And two, we have a classroom management system that we're now looking at to make sure that all classrooms are included in that. We have a situation where some of those classrooms have not been put into that system. And then third, we do have an initiative around now looking at technology in classrooms and trying to upgrade and bringing up classrooms to a consistent level. So all of those, I think, are the short-term issues. The longer-term issues, of course, require building space and building more classrooms. But I think those three are the things we're focusing on now to try and alleviate this problem.
Thank you, Mike.
We have another in-person speaker. Identify yourself, please.
Hi, my name is Beth Millis. I'm from Performing and Media Arts. Thank you for being here, and I really appreciate the update. It's exciting. I'm going to echo what Buzz has just said and Tara as well. It's come up recently in our department about the escalation of administrative tasks and how it makes us feel that we're not as available to both our undergraduates and graduate students. I feel like this in my capacity on the University Assembly as well. There have been a lot of conversations. So I guess the question is, and you've answered it, but I'm just standing here already. So I wanted to say none of us want to complain, or a lot of us don't want to complain because we feel privileged to be here and to work through the pandemic. It seems specific to post-pandemic life that we just have much more than we can handle. And the burden's on our staff as well. And so we don't want to push it off.
So I appreciate hearing this because we don't want this. We want our faculty to be the world's best researchers and teachers. Can you give me an example? I mean, help me understand.
A specific example is sort of the necessity students post-pandemic, if they are ill and we have to create a Zoom, then we have to create it ourselves. And that specific, many students are experiencing mental distress beyond anything we've experienced. And we're all struggling, all of us, to be there for our students. But there are many, many more escalation of things to do.
Okay. Okay. So that's helpful. So it's not, this is, I just make sure I understand.
Yeah.
So it's not so much the compliance kind of things. It actually has to do with teaching, added burden to teaching.
Showing up for our students, teaching, mentoring, all of it.
Okay.
Thank
please.
You.
Please.
And thank you for asking.
So I think many of you are aware of the pilot program that Vice Provost Lisa Nishi, she's going to present it. So I think it will address one of your issues. We're very aware of the tremendous burden of the increase in accommodations that are required for students and what that does and makeup tests and makeup classes, et cetera. So there is an effort that will be presented around trying to alleviate that burden.
And for what it's worth, since you mentioned mental health, and I actually brought notes because I knew I would forget the range of things, let me give you a very quick update on what we're doing with mental health for our students. It is a huge concern. Every meeting I go to with other presidents or other administrators, it's always like one of the top topics. How do we keep up with this demand for mental health? We have engaged a group called Mantra Health, which is a telehealth therapy group, and they're supplementing our campus mental health and psychotropic medication management. With this, we've actually cut down the wait times from access. A year ago, it was 12.2 days. Now it's only 2.3 days. So that's helped. We've invested very heavily in staffing. I know it doesn't feel like it, but best practices nationally are that you have a student to therapist ratio of between 1,000 and 1,500 to one. We're at 625 to one, and that doesn't even count the teletherapy. We have a brand new director of counseling and psychological services, CAPS. His name is David Reitz. He comes to us from RIT, and he's also the immediate past president of the big national organization on college counseling. So we think he'll have some new good ideas. And importantly, I also do want to mention that we just adopted the Okanagan Charter. You may have heard about that. This makes us a health promoting campus. When I talk with Ryan Lombardi about this, basically his view, and he's really studied this a lot, is we're never going to catch up by hiring therapists. We have to get it upstream before the mental health crises happen. And the goal of this Okanagan Charter is to try and do that. That doesn't directly answer your question, but it does give you a sense that we're trying to. And by the way, I apologize. I'm not sick. I had COVID 2 weeks ago, and I'm still just kind of dealing with the aftermath of that.
Okay, I think we have time for another question and answer.
Thanks. My name is Carl Frank. I'm from physics, and I also want to deeply express my appreciation of how you folks got us through the pandemic. And also it remains a privilege to be here teaching and doing research. And I'm going to ask questions that I don't expect a quick answer to.
Okay.
But I would appreciate when the time is ripe. And so being a faculty senator from a year or so ago, we were deeply involved in the response to your charge of the anti-racism. Mm-hmm. And to be frank, it has not impacted whatever was supposed to happen, has not touched me as a faculty member. but to get your sense of where that has gone to. And I realize it's a big hot potato, but it was, you won't believe how much time we invested in our departments and in the Senate over that. The second question is something that's also somewhat divisive, and I don't expect a quick one. But the other thing that was revealed toward the end of Charlie's tenure as dean of faculty was what, in the opinion of some of us, is a very loose vetting process on the question of our involvement with other international things. And this became almost a technical detail about whether it was inter-college or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what I would really ask is, we need to know a little bit about red lines. Mm-hmm. When they're crossed. We see as a nation our involvement, for example, with Saudi Arabia, we're getting to find red lines and where they're crossed. So I think we need more information. I think as a faculty senator, it was unfortunate that we thought we got to the point where the discussion was going to go on to the next semester. Mm-hmm. Instead, it just happened. So again, it's not a fast question to ask, but I'm just reflecting on the amount of time was spent here in this group on this. So not to give a quick one, but
no, but let me answer. First of all, the first question I can't answer. So the two main things that came out, there were three, but let me focus on two of the things that came out from that work on anti-racism. One was the creation of a racial justice and equitable futures center. And I can tell you that we are in the final stages of interviewing directors for that center. That should be announced hopefully by the end of the semester, and then the person will come and that will get set up. So yes, it took a long time, but I can assure you that it hasn't disappeared. We are actively interviewing people now, and I'm actually very excited about the candidates. The what was decided on the educational component for students was that it didn't make sense to have a campus-wide class. And I think that makes a lot of sense, right? What will be most appropriate for a student in anthropology might be very, very different from what will be appropriate for a student in Dyson. And so each school and college has been working on those requirements independently. My understanding is that a number of the schools and colleges have already stood up those programs, and all of them, at least at the undergraduate level, are working on the process of getting them there. So those things, I agree with you, it's taken, you know, universities, we don't move quickly, but they are moving forward. On the other, what I would recommend is that you have Wendy Wolford come and talk with you, our Vice Provost for International Affairs. I do want to say that I am a firm believer that we need to maintain our relationships with other countries, not necessarily the governments, but that human to human, academic to academic integration is incredibly important, and it's at our peril that we give that up. That said, I think you're right. There are red lines, and it would be worth inviting Wendy to come and talk with you about that. Thank you.
Hey, I think that's probably enough. Thanks so much.
We have thank you all.
Agenda.
Okay, enjoy. Take care. Thank you.
So we're going to move on to a pilot project update, centralized support for student disability services, SDS, accommodations. Lisa Nishi. Is here or online? There you are. Okay. And she will have 10 minutes to present, and we'll devote 15 minutes to discussion afterwards.
That's great. Trouble. Can I hold it?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm here to tell you about a pilot program for providing support. I walked in right as I think somebody may have been asking a question or commenting on the increasing number of students, right, with SDS accommodations. And over the last 2 years or so, I would say I've heard more and more and more about this from faculty, from associate deans. And so we decided to try a pilot. I want to preface this by saying that I don't oversee student disability services. did initiate this pilot. This caveat is just to say, I might not be able to answer questions if you have them about some detailed processes within SDS, but I do want to tell you about the pilot. Do I advance next, please? Okay, so I want to provide you with a little bit of context. Here is what the increase has looked like. This is just for testing accommodations. There are other kinds of accommodations as well. And this is the last 5 years, doesn't include this year, but you'll see 5 years ago, we had 748. This is just undergraduate students. Last year, we had 1,872. That's a total increase of 150%. So what you're feeling, right, is represented in the numbers here. Next, please. The numbers are a little bit off here, but they are good enough to give you a sense for the number of, so this is the grand total of students with extended time testing accommodations within the undergraduate population. So it's really the number of students with those testing accommodations times the courses in which they are using those accommodations. So some students, for example, only have them for math-related exams, writing-related, and so forth. And they also have the option to activate or not activate their accommodation for a particular course. So that's quite a high number, as you see. Okay, so that's the context. Next, please. So we started with the spring by providing support just to evening prelims. And, you know, it's actually a lot easier to support evening prelims because we know when they are, right? There aren't other classes and sessions, so we can have access to classrooms. And so it was pretty straightforward, but it was still important for us to figure out the logistics, things like how do we get exams from faculty and how do we return the exams and how many proctors will we need? We learned a lot of things like we should always have two proctors in a classroom because if a proctor has to go to the bathroom or a proctor has to go ask a question of the, you know, in the main classroom where the main exam is, there's still a proctor left in the class. This fall, we decided to pilot support for daytime tests. This is far more complicated, as I know all of you know, because you've had to, you know, do this on your own. But they're complicated because we classroom space is difficult for us to get. And students with extended time often have course conflicts, right, before or after their class. That makes it difficult for us to schedule the concurrent exams. And also the proctors also have classes, right? And so they're just it's just a lot more complicated. This year, this semester, we are supporting roughly about 70 courses and 60 unique faculty. Next, please. So a little bit on how we selected our sample for the pilot. We sent out a survey over the summer to all faculty who were listed as a primary instructor for a course in the fall semester and sent a few reminders. We got 140 responses. I think it's because it was a summer survey and faculty were taking much needed rest, but that was okay. And from that, we asked, you know, for what aspects of this do you most need help? And would you be interested in having central support if we're able to provide it? From that, we really just focused on those faculty who said they wanted help with all of it. And when I say wraparound help, that includes rooms, right? Finding the rooms and reserving them, finding proctors, assigning proctors, coordinating with students directly, collecting the exams, resolving scheduling conflicts, the whole works. And the reason we focused on faculty who needed all of it was not just because it seemed like the higher need faculty, but because the system as we set up has these elements coupled together. So actually doing kind of a la carte help, we weren't sure we could handle the extra work that would provide. And we didn't want to overpromise and underdeliver. In the end, we ended up with about 32 courses that were part of the daytime testing pilot program. Next, please. So this is how it works. Faculty who are part of the pilot were granted access. Everybody, all faculty, you have the SDS faculty portal. If you don't know about it or use it, I would recommend you check it out. You can see all the students in your class who have different types of accommodations. But we told faculty in our pilot to go to a specific section of the faculty portal so that they could complete a form that gives us really vital information, right? So things like, what's the earliest time you'd be okay with starting an accommodated test, the latest possible end time? What are the restrictions on supplemental materials and technology? How can we contact you, right? Contact information. How should we handle content questions? Keeping in mind the need to maintain equity across the main testing room, right? And the accommodated testing room. How would you like us to, how would you like to drop off and have your exams delivered back? So all of that stuff. And then we asked them to tell their students to please activate, I say activate, SDS says register, their testing accommodations at least 5 days prior to the first exam. This is important in that there are a few ways in which this whole thing is different from typical semesters and communication and kind of clarity of who's supposed to do what is something that I think we can strengthen in semesters to come. Students then went to their version of their side of the SDS portal to register, and this connects essentially the data we get from students and faculty. And then SDS provides all the support. So for faculty, all the exam details, portal support, proctor management, and for students, communicating all the logistics. After each exam, the proctors provide an exam report to faculty. So things like attendance or if something kind of weird happened, right? Just to make sure the faculty know about it. And we ask all students, this is in the middle part, to send their questions to sdstesting@cornell.edu. I mentioned this because some faculty said, we sent emails and we never heard back, but they sent them to another email address and we didn't get them. And so this is just another one of those things we need to iron out to make sure everyone's on the same page. Next, please. So successes so far, we have been able to support every exam in the pilot that has requested support. I think we're up to about 119 exams at this point. We have had hiccups, absolutely, but we've learned a lot from them, and faculty have been really great, patient. I think a lot of them also thankful for the fact that we're taking this burden off their shoulders, but also helping us think through some of the hiccups when they happen, right? Because we're building this as we go. We've created an extensive proctor pool. We had 160 students, so I'm getting used to reading glasses, as you can see. We had 160 students apply. We only have hired graduate and professional students. We don't think undergrads should be proctoring undergrad exams. But we have a pool of 80, and it's kind of a gig economy. So at the beginning of every week, we post the exams, the times where we need proctors, and proctors sign up. If it's something that they want to do. So it doesn't add pressure to them, which we think is important. And it's a nice source of additional income. Campus stakeholders, how many more minutes do I have? None?
Probably about one.
Okay. Are really key to our success. I'll get to this. Actually, I'll just go to the next slide, please. So finding rooms, this is the biggest headache. Maybe you all know this. Some departments, so some challenges, specific ones, some departments have been somewhat unwilling to share their rooms. The unfortunate part about this is we'll submit a request. It takes, can take up to 7 days to hear back. And then we're told the rooms are only available for department use. It would have been nice for us not to waste the 7 days, because then once you're within 48-hour period, you can't request a room, right? And we're just constantly trying to get rooms. And issues with having access. Anyway, rooms are a big deal. It would be enormously helpful if departments knew, the schedulers knew, to prioritize our requests and think there are ways in which we can make it clearer to them that we're doing this to support faculty and we can't do it without them. And one other thing I want to say, I know I'm out of time, students right now don't have to activate their accommodation right away. What this has meant for us is as the semester goes, a student decides, actually, I do want to use my accommodation in this class. The number of students requiring an extended time test changes. And in the beginning of the semester, we would, we're a day or two before the exam, and all of a sudden the rooms that we reserve don't work, right? And then we're scrambling to find rooms. So We'd like to try to move up that deadline to make it more manageable. I have other challenges, but if you want me to stop, I can stop.
I think you can take a minute or two more, and we'll just have a little bit less time for the question and answer.
Okay. So next slide then, please. Like I said, scheduling conflicts are challenging, and they're inevitable. Some students really do have classes both before and after. I don't think it's a huge percent, but it turns out we probably spend 99% of our time trying to figure out what to do with those. And it's obviously not appropriate for faculty to expect students to skip their next class, right? And so figuring out what's acceptable for the faculty as well as what works for students, it's a lot of back and forth. One thought that I've been kicking around is maybe the default in future semesters should be, if you can't take the exam at a concurrent time, at 8 a.m. is the slot, right? And it would be before the main exam. I think there are good reasons for that Eve has shared with me. And we have more classroom space at 8 o'clock because our classes aren't as spread out as they should be. And 10 to 2 o'clock is the hardest time. We have too much compression between 10 and 2 on most days. We have a greater percentage of courses than we should scheduled at this time, and it makes it really difficult for us to find classrooms. Next, please. Okay, last slide. Actually, I won't go through all of this. One thing I will say is that we're working in a system that was built for colleges and universities that have a centralized testing center. And so that's what we're finding along the way, is that we're bumping into things that the system expects we can do that we can't. We think we can hack some of these things, but we have to take down the whole system in order to do it, which we're not going to do in the middle of the semester for obvious reasons, but we hope to be able to work through some of them in this spring. And we hope to partner with many of you, your colleges and your departments, in setting aside rooms so that we can support more faculty.
Thank you.
Sure.
Stay here. If you're in Zoom and you have a question, please raise your digital hand. If you're in person and have a question, please walk up to the front. And normally we start with Zoom, but I don't see any Zooms right yet. So why don't you?
Thank you. My name's Carl Frank from Physics. So let's be clear. The purpose of a proctor is to look for cheats and look after that. There's another way of doing this. When I left the University of Virginia, students were totally responsible for the enforcement of an honor code system. Faculty all had only one role, which is to provide information. A typical exam would have been given by a faculty member going into the room, passing out the exam. Any questions? No questions. If you have a question, here's where you'll find me. Leave the room. If you're SBS, you have more time. The whole issue of, it's unbelievable how much you're paying people for the PhDs to schedule these things, which were totally soft targeted. The problem is we haven't bought into a system like that. And we are, if it was a business, you would have to look at it and say, Virginia's got it, had it figured out. So it just seems like you're never going to fill in this hole. And so let's try something else. That's what I'm trying to say. The other thing is, down the hall there, Physics 101, we have a place where a person, we observe the students as they teach, as they take a multiple choice exam. There's even a lock that sets off an alarm to the police when somebody tries to break in and do it. This place is not right. This is something crazy. It's been going on for as long as I've been here. It's not a good system. The students know that the message we send them is we don't trust them. That's not what we want to do with these kids. And so I really hope that somehow a pilot or something can be done to try what amounts to a UVA honor system.
Right. So that intersects with another, thing I think that's on radar for this year, hopefully, is our academic integrity system. Yeah, I hear you. I've heard others express that same, it's a big pain point.
Please identify yourself in person.
Pete Wolzansky from chemistry and chemical biology. We've looked into this problem for a number of years. And in fact, we've requested information from from the administration from a number of times. Tom Rutledge, for example, in courses of organic chemistry and in freshman chemistry. And I don't think that you're looking at the real problem here. If you provide the demographics of the people who are requesting these SDS hours and half hours, and you know, it's surprising. We've done a little bit of our own homework on this because we have not been able to get the information from administration. We found out there's a preponderance of people from Westchester County. And staggeringly enough, very few African-Americans require these sorts of things. You're barking up the wrong tree with regard to a lot of this SDS information. And so, you know, I mean, the only thing I've found an incredible frustration, I mean, it's, maybe it's not Felicity Huffman to you, but man, after 40 years of this crap, it's a pain in the ass to me. So the only thing that I've started to do is give take-home exams and then give the exams open-ended.
Right. I mean, I do think that that's a good solution.
But you need to look into the demographics of the clientele that you're spending a lot of money on, because I'll tell you, from our perspective, it's not worth it.
Yeah, I think our hope is for students who need it and don't yet have, right, haven't been diagnosed or don't have accommodations that they have access to that care here.
It might be a huge, because maybe we could actually get the people who deserve it.
Well, I'm just going to check the Zoom again. Still nothing. We have in-person speaker. Go ahead.
Buzz Barstow again, biological and environmental engineering. Actually, Pete asked my question much more eloquently than I could have possibly asked it. So I'm going to give my time to somebody else who can ask a better question. Thank you.
Okay, Debbie Turney on Zoom.
Okay, in regards to our previous speaker, I found that a lot of our underrepresented students and first generation students may not realize they have a disability. They don't know where to go. And as of a little bit ago, they had to pay for their own testing. So how are we getting around this and getting the information to them that there are services available to them?
It's a good question. I think it's a little bit out of scope for me, to be honest, but it's something that I will discuss with our Cornell Health colleagues about the availability, I was going to say exams, but that feels, to be able to be diagnosed if they have learning disabilities, but also make sure that communication is clear. And reaching them early on.
We have an in-person speaker, questioner.
Thank you, Tara Holm again. Thank you, Lisa. I know we've talked a lot about this, and the math department, just like the other big sciences departments that we've been hearing from, face a lot of these challenges. I think they also underscore the need for staff. I think the just the sheer quantity of SDS accommodations. Some of my faculty are participating in your pilot, but some of my faculty are not because we have a huge faculty. And I think this underscores for Martha precisely the point. I ran into a colleague last night who was in just trying to manage the 52 students in his big course who needed various types of accommodations. And it's overwhelming to faculty. So administrative support, we do have some administrative support in the department, but the administrators are also completely overwhelmed. And so more support, very much appreciated.
I think you know this already, but if you need just proctors, extra proctors to help.
Thank you.
Yeah,
we do know
that.
We
can help you with that. Yeah.
We have a Zoom questioner, Ken Berman.
Hi, Lisa. Yeah, Ken Berman, computer science. And by the way, let me just say, just as everybody was thanking Martha and Mike, I just want to thank you also, Lisa, for how much you did during the COVID period. And of course, this is a problem coming out of it. My question relates to whether we've actually studied the SDS accommodation process itself. Because I've certainly during the COVID period, I got overwhelming numbers of really peculiar accommodation requests coming through SDS that sometimes didn't seem easy to rationalize for me as a faculty member. It seems to have diminished, and maybe this is a problem that went away on its own, But I am wondering what level of confidence the administration has that SDS is vetting these properly and giving appropriate accommodations.
Great question. Again, I can't speak to the processes currently underway, but we have started various conversations to try to go through all of this and to really understand what is happening, what's behind these numbers, not just here, like better understand also our peers, right, at the national level. So we've heard you. I can't say we're going to solve everything right away, but we're on it. Ken, trying.
Do you have any other Zoom?
I don't think so.
Okay. I think then maybe we will move on again because of our fact agenda. Thank you so much.
I wonder if I can turn this on.
We have two committee updates, Senate committee updates. The first from the University Faculty Library Board, report on library research infrastructure. Rachel West is, Weil, sorry, that's my eyes.
Everybody's struggling with their glasses.
We'll try for 10 minutes and.
Control my own light.
Would you like the mic or a handheld or a lavalier?
No.
Okay. I think you'll have to say next.
Can I say next? Okay, thank you for having me here today. I'm going to take this off for now. So the first slide simply tells you who we are next and what our job. Yeah, that might be it. Sorry, it's really disconcerting to me not to see it. And what we were tasked with. There were six of us split between three in science and three in the humanities. Three things to keep in mind. One, we were an all faculty committee. There were no members from the library. Two, we were only asked to look at the role at the library's role in the research mission of the university, not its teaching mission. I think that would be a whole different report and one that should be written. Finally, this report was written during 2021 and 22 and submitted July 2022. So it is a snapshot of the state of affairs in the library before the new librarian, Elaine Westbrook, took over. Next slide. Our hopes for the report. This is an educational document. It is a call to conversation. We are not trying to prescribe or micromanage the library. We believe that if Cornell is to meet the challenges that we outline here, it's important for faculty and administrators to understand these challenges. So we hope the report will be widely read, and we thank you in advance for your assistance in making that happen. Next slide. Here is our understanding of the library's core mission, right, which has not really changed since the 19th or 20th centuries, right? It is to help us get the materials, the literature, and data that we need to do our research. Next slide. There are other aspects of the mission that we identify in the report, which are newer, and we also lay out the challenges that the library faces in fulfilling these missions. Next slide. So these are the challenges. I will only talk about some of them here. Next slide. The first biggest, I think we all know, is the rising cost of cereals, the dominance of the big five publishers, whose dominance is worrisome in other ways as well. Next. The emergence of open access publishing, which we have defined for you here as a model that shifts the costs from the reader to the author. In other words, you pay to publish rather than pay to read. There are many questions swirling around this model and its variants. Do we subsidize our faculty to help them publish in these journals? Is this actually a form of extortion? What are the ethics of open access publishing? Is this a model that ultimately makes scholarly communities more democratic, or does it make them more exclusionary? So we discuss these in the report. Another kind of challenge, next slide. I feel like I need to go back one. Digital collections, yes. Another challenge, we can now buy materials in digital form, right? This is different from the 20th century, and a number of challenges and questions arise from that. Sometimes we have a choice. This raises questions of what to invest in, and the report spends some time on the pros and cons of what at one point we called the new utopia of digital-only publication. We do not think that there is a new utopia of only digital publication. Other challenges discussed in the report, next slide. Some of these, I'm naming still only a few, relating to the need for improvements to the physical space of the library, relating to our struggles to attract and retain people of color in high positions in the library, and the increasing demand on our digital research services, with the understanding that the demand itself is a good thing. It is meeting it that's a challenge. Next slide. I want to say something about how we put the report together. I've listed our sources of information. We have worked with publicly available information from the Association of Research Libraries. We did extensive interviews with librarians, and we made use of two surveys, one of which was conducted by the library itself, which it generously shared with us, the other of which we conducted ourselves. Some caveats about using these surveys. They were all done in 2021, and that, of course, changes things because you're still in the pandemic. And second of all, neither survey got a particularly high rate of response. Nonetheless, we would like to talk about what emerged in these surveys in order to flag certain issues. Before I plunge into that, I just want to say, really what came out of surveys is that for the most part, faculty are very pleased with the library. We received many, many positive comments about the library. It is therefore with regret that I plunge into the negative, but I think I need to flag the issues that our report flagged and which I think are structural issues, not things for which we blame the library personnel. So the takeaways, key takeaways, yes, it's up on the screen. For example, 22% of the faculty in the College of Arts and Sciences said that cuts to the budget negatively affected their research. The responses varied across colleges, so Arts and Sciences was admittedly the harshest, but we find numbers like that. Next slide. If we turn to what people actually complain about, we find issues such as unannounced cuts to journals. People talk about their need to go outside the Cornell University library system. And so what I've tried to do here, next slide, is direct what I think are the structural issues underlying the responses. These include the loss of purchasing power by the library, lapses in communication between the library and the faculty, and what we call the get it Cornell problem. By way of explanation, next slide. It's a big thing in my life. This is from my own research. The get it Cornell button is a little button that appears when you search databases, often for journals. when you push the button to get your newly discovered article at Cornell, next slide, you get something like this. Your resource wasn't found, but it may be available. In this case that I'm showing you, the library actually had my resource. So this is created by a faulty interface between the journal database provided by an outside vendor and the library catalog that leads people to think that the library does not have something that the library, in fact, does have. So next slide. Our report identifies several areas of investment to address the issues flagged in the surveys, as well as issues flagged in conversations with librarians and in the publicly available data. I only have space for some here. Next slide. Large issue investment in collections. And we mean here the acquisitions of materials, be they print or digital or in some other form. Statistics from the Association of Research Libraries show that our level of investment has declined relative to peer institutions and also relative to ourselves in the past. So you can look at these statistics in our actual report. Next slide. But clearly, more than just money for buying collections is needed. Cornell needs to engage in collective action to bring down the cost of journals and to combat predatory practices among publishers. We note that it has a history of doing that. We urge it to do more and therefore to invest in the legal and technical expertise required to do it. Next slide. Also, clearly, building and maintaining collections is not enough. Collections need to be discoverable. And as librarians repeatedly told us, if researchers don't know that we have an item, there is no point in having it. And so we identify challenges that have impeded the discoverability of materials, challenges such as the poor quality of metadata provided by vendors, the fact that cataloging is actually very labor intensive and requires staff. We urge investment in this area. Next slide. So as should be clear, Cornell has hard choices to make in terms of how to develop collections, what models of open access publishing to encourage, how to resist predatory publishers. If faculty are to participate in these choices, there need to be good avenues of communication between faculty and the library. We believe so far we don't have a consistently successful mechanism for that. And we ask in particular for a reevaluation of the library liaison system, which has been the dominant means of creating avenues of communication. Next slide. No, go back one. So I have only covered some of the necessary investments identified in our report. For others, I've highlighted the ones that I did not talk about. Please read the report. Next slide. Rand's conclusion, the Cornell Library System is being asked to do even more with even less. It is slipping in relation to its peers. The restoration of the budget to pre-pandemic levels is not enough to rectify the deficits we identify. Substantial investments are required in materials and staffing and technology. Thank you.
Hold on to it in case. Oh, okay.
Sorry.
We have time for a couple of questions and answers. If you're here, come to the microphone. If you're on Zoom, raise your hand. And I don't see any Zoom hands, so why don't we start in person? I guess we'll have to share them all. No. Identify yourself.
Louis Shang, College of Veterinary Medicine. Thank you very much for the work, most appreciated. I really want to emphasize an item that you brought, which is the publishing model going into a predatory mode everywhere. So Nature now charges $12,000 for an open issue. So it's not a joke.
Yeah.
So that is basically forbidden people from other places to publish. And I really think that Cornell should take a leadership position in fighting that trend because it's just unacceptable. These are public funds.
I agree. What am I supposed to do? This? Okay.
Still no Zoom people, so we'll take another in person. I can't do it. Yeah,
that's right. Thank you. Tara Holm from the mathematics department. If you read the section on, I'm sure you read the section on transparency, the math department is one of at least two, but maybe only two departments that has a library committee. We're very committed to our library. Our needs in our library are very different from the other STEM fields whose budgets we are lumped in with. We need books. They need journals, and we have had serious problems getting the books that we need. And even worse, many of the endowments that we have built up through donations from alumni over the years have been sort of consolidated into some kind of central budget for the sciences. And a lot of us are quite unhappy with the situation. So I echo your calls for transparency, and I hope that we can rectify the situation. Yeah.
We have a couple of Zoom people. Sarah Fryer.
Hi, thanks for a sterling report. So in terms of thinking about your call for action that Cornell should be banding together with other peer institutions to try and push back a little bit on publishers and in terms of the fees that now we're being asked to pay, do you see particularly useful examples elsewhere that can be implemented here? So, you know, is the best practice that's available to us?
That is an excellent question, which I do not feel equipped to answer. We didn't make any studies of other institutions. I would say this is all the more reason why there needs to be a conversation. I think Elaine Westbrook is exactly the person to lead this conversation. No, I can't say there's another model. I think I can say any successful effort would probably have to involve Cornell.
I think we only have time for one more comment in person, and then we'll move on.
Charles Walcott, Neurobiology and Behavior. It seems unrealistic that the Cornell Library can have all the materials that one is ever going to need. What kind of arrangements are there for the current the interlibrary loans, of course?
Yes.
But what that must also be available on the internet in some way. So it would seem to me that one of the things to do is to work with other libraries and have a group of libraries who are perhaps specialists in some areas.
Well,
what is going on in that kind of cooperative effort?
I mean, again, this is something that should be directed to the library. I think you say something really important, which is the dream of a library that has everything is just a pipe dream. I mean, maybe the Library of Congress, but I'm not even sure. So that access is always going to involve consortiums, cooperation with other libraries. It's also going to involve licensing agreements. One of the really interesting things that I learned, because I learned a lot from this report, is that one of the problems with licensing digital books, you know, a lot of people think, well, it's way cheaper if the library wants a book to get the digital version rather than the print version. One of the issues with that is that there are publishers who are licensing to you, but not giving you the book, put restrictions on how much you can lend to another library, which totally makes economic sense from their point of view. So that's why we need to know what we're doing. I mean, yes, we need to engage collectively. This is why we might need to be a bit skeptical about digital publications. It is why we need to invest in expertise, which is not just technological. You know, how do you find out what's out there? How do you get it quickly? But it's also legal increasingly. And that is one of the reasons that we say very strongly in the report, and I just want to emphasize this again, there should not be an either or choice
between investing in materials or investing in the people who understand the cataloging, the databasing, the discoverability, the legal situation, right? Those two things have to go together.
Hey, Joe.
Oh. Yes.
I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut off discussion on this very important topic, and we need to move on to our next committee report, the Senate Committee Update Financial Policies Committee, FPC. Louis Shang, Chair, Microbiology and Immunology, has 5 minutes, and then 5 minutes for Q&A.
Hello, can you hear me? Okay. As it was mentioned, my name is Louis Shang, College of Veterinary Medicine, Microbiology and Immunology, and Baker Institute. If we can have, thank you very much, on the screen, the webpage of the Financial Policies Committee. So this is a Senate committee that is tasked with basically interacting with administration in the budget planning processes, and basically the key issues here being fulfilling the mission of the university of affordability and providing instruction for everybody, and at the same time, having the best faculty. Now, I'm not sure it's very well known, but the main income of the Cornell University is tuition and fees. The main expense is salaries. So, of course, in a high inflation environment, to keep the best faculty, particularly to recruit diverse faculty in this competitive environment, you need higher salaries, which, of course, creates the problem of affordability for the students. So there is a tension in the Cornell model for affordability. So the committee is 11 people, and it was a big turnaround this year. I'm a new chair. I just started. This is my third, 4 month as a chair of the committee, so I'm still learning the ropes. And everybody who see there, who is 2025 at the right side, that means it's a new member of the committee this year. As you can see, it's a very large turnover and many new members in the committee. So, just 1 second. Basically, the committee engages every year with administration, and actually, Vice Provost Otrukov has been extremely supportive of the committee and very open and participating every year. And we go over and support administration and get feedback from administration about the budgeting process for the following year. So this year we have monthly meetings. Just give me 1 second, please. So we have monthly committees through the terms, and the first, the annual reports from the previous years, you can also access them from the website, and they are all available for all of you to see. So this year we have had so far 1, 2, 3, 4 meetings, and the first two meetings were invested in basically introductions, presenting ourselves and setting up the schedule and the objectives for the year. And we have decided to prioritize, not surprisingly, in this year on the effects of inflation, both in faculty salaries as much as on affordability of students, and also on the endowment. So after those meetings, we actually had a meeting with Chief Investment Officer Ken Miranda, who was very kind, making himself available, and presented to the committee basically the strategies that the endowment is using. As you may have known or not, there has been a significant turnaround in the performance of the endowment that used to be usually at the bottom of the Ivy Plus or the Ivy schools, and now it's close to the top. For the last 2 years, actually has outperformed significantly all the benchmarks and all the other ones. And what are the strategies that are going to be used with respect to a high inflation environment? He was extremely informative, providing good vision of the general management of the fund, and is actually a fairly aggressive, heavily invested in equity. And one of the major differences that they have done from the past is having a significant amount available in more liquid investments that they can be repositioned according to the needs. But the goal is long-term growth and to have the fund growing indefinitely to support Cornell University mission. We met as well with Vice Provost Kotlikoff and Vice Provost Sayer, going through the budgets, actuals and budgets for the fiscal year 21, 22, 23, and starting to preview the fiscal year 24 guidance, which is, of course, the one that is going to be significantly affected by inflation. And they are using basically the inflation trends by the Congress Budgetary Office, which at the moment is around 5%. I think it's a little optimistic, but that's the macroeconomics, not my specialty. And I think I'm run out of time, and I'm very happy to answer any questions.
So if there are questions in Zoom, raise your hand. If you're here and have a question, just step up to the microphone. We'll wait just a few seconds to see. I don't see any hands in Zoom. And you have a minute more of things that you wanted to say?
Yeah, basically I wanted to invite the members of the faculty to bring any concerns, questions, or any items or any issues that you think related to the financial policies of the university and how they impact the education mission and the research mission of the university. Please bring them to us and we'll be very happy.
Thank you. We have Senate announcements and it updates usually at the front of the meeting, today at the end, with Dean of Faculty Eve DeRosa, Psychology, and Chelsea Specht, Associate Dean of Faculty, Chair of Nominations and Elections Committee, Plant Biology. Today, Chelsea, okay.
Well, no, I'm just going to say something really quickly. Thank you, Luis, very much for your presentation. And if any of you hear these presentations by any of these subcommittees and think, gosh, I really need to be on that committee because I have a voice to be heard, right? This is your chance. So feel free to either write to Jill or CA or to the chair of the committee and say, hey, I'd like to be on that committee, and we'll make sure that information gets forward. So thank you.
And even better, invite your friends. So yes, it doesn't just have to be you self-nominating. We really do appreciate the work on the Senate committees, and that you can see just even from today's presentations, the Faculty Library Board and the Financial Policies Committees, there's really deep thought going on and a lot of work that's going on outside of the Senate that comes to us and for us to consider. So I just want to put a plug in for those who want to continue to volunteer beyond the Senate. And the more that we can get Senate committee members, senators onto the committees, even better, because then that facilitates the integration. What's happening on those local committees. And just want to also remind you that I am representing the university faculty committee, and there are members of the university faculty committee here to answer questions as well. Just want to share that. And then actually one slide back, please. Oh, no, that's fine. So we have courageously taken on updating the user experience on the Dean of Faculty website. So we're going to send a link to the senators and a few other places that I think can give us really quality feedback on how to find information in a more efficient way. And so I will be sending a link, or Jill will be sending a link. And I just want to let you know, this will go out in the Monday message, but the conflict of interest system is changing so that it becomes a rolling system, and there will be more details in the Monday message. The faculty forum, and I should say, I think based on the response of people in the room, we can give more space to library conversations with the future of academic communication if needed. We have a forum date protected, and so we can build something, and maybe we can also bring in the university librarian if she's available. So if you're interested in that, please email the Dean of Faculty office and we can see if we can arrange something for, I believe is November 30th. And I just wanted to also just give a brief summary of what we discussed for the October faculty forum. So we brought Ken Berman from Computer and Information Sciences brought forward the idea of reactivating the research scientist titles. And there does seem to be a lot of energy around doing so. And so we discussed this on the forum, and it also sounds like there's a need for this in the extension faculty as well. And a lot of it is because they're dependent on soft money coming in to support their positions. And then when they actually apply to research institutions, either they need a faculty sponsor, so they can't independently send a grant. And then also when they do a drop-down menu, there is no such thing as an associate who would be serving as a principal investigator. And so they have to literally have to other themselves. And a lot of them feel like it's very marginalizing having to choose other. So one, not having the independence to submit a grant on their own, and then also having to select other. And so at the moment, research scientist is described in a way that's very much like almost one for one with the research professor. And so in order to do this well and not to create other complications for the faculty, we are going to take a lot of care in how we describe the research scientist and potentially extension scientist. So we will be working on it. We'll be working with HR and other places on campus and bring this back to the Senate. Does look like this is a real need, and there's some energy behind us doing this. And then next slide, please. And then I just wanted to, and this is related to the presentation we just had from Vice Provost Lisa Nishi on the student disability services. We are also convening all of the chairs of the academic integrity hearing boards. We are trying to learn. We have learned that there isn't an even application, and there are cultural definitions of academic integrity. But we want to now set a standard that can be applied evenly across all of the colleges and schools, so that a student, no matter where they have their academic integrity concern, is getting equal treatment, and that this is faculty driven in terms of our academic freedom and our ability to define what we think is a concern in terms of academic integrity. And we also, at this time, want to look at the efficiency of the process. At the moment, it does involve a lot of steps for the faculty to pursue academic integrity concerns. And so we'll try to do both of those things, but we're going to first start by convening all the chairs and understanding how the academic integrity process is actually being done by each college and school. And then we'll move forward with that. So more to come on that. And I'm open for questions if anyone has them, and also the UFC and Chelsea.
And if you're on Zoom, please raise your hand. I see nothing on Zoom. Oh, I take it back. Ken Berman, you're on.
Yeah, Ken Berman, computer science. I simply want to thank Dean DeRosa for pursuing this, and particularly the research scientist titles. I'm glad that there's a recognition now that that cutting those titles off has caused an issue for people. And just applaud the process of doing this carefully and doing it correctly. And then we'll look forward to having it come back to the Senate when you have a detailed plan.
Eve, were there any good of the order today? Then,
but I do have an announcement.
Okay, announcement.
We have cookies. Very important. So on your way out, pick up a cookie for those of you.
Yeah, and we have digital cookies.
For the digital cookie people. Does not exist, but maybe next time. But I just wanted to thank you all for physically coming and being here today.
Thank you, everyone. We are adjourned to cookies.